Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai with Arvind joining you live from our studios in Prashanthi Nilayam. We are here to continue the satsang that we started a couple of fortnights ago, and we had last week also the continuation of that. The satsang on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, which were questions and answers sessions which Dr. John Hislop, one of Swami's revered devotees, had with Swami. We've had three sessions. This is the fourth session of those conversations. To say the least, it's pretty profound, and honestly speaking, we are not really, I don't know if we are wise enough to keep up with the discussion. In many ways, that's what we are seeing. But thanks to this program and thanks to sharing this with all of you, I think we are looking at this conversation much, much more deeply than we would have done otherwise. And I'm sure together we can understand and draw much more from this conversation, which is very, very beautiful and profound, than we would have done otherwise. So we are grateful to all of you for that. And of course, we are eternally grateful for Swami for giving us this opportunity. So let's begin, as always, by offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, and thank you for that disclaimer, because as you rightly said, even as we are exploring this beautiful book, we are getting thrilled with different revelations and thoughts, but we can no way claim that this is a comprehensive explanation or a comprehensive discussion. That is why it is beautiful that it's just a satsang. It's just a sharing of wonderful thoughts, and these are the most wonderful thoughts because they source from Bhagwan himself. I would like to quickly recap in brief what we had discussed last week. Swami was explaining to Hislop and the others in the interview room. It is evident that there are others. From the conversation, we understand that there are at least 3-4 others participating in this conversation, along with Hislop and his wife. There is also a translator who is possibly translating from Telugu to English. So, what Swami tells Hislop and the others is that the ultimate experience is called the ultimate experience because it is something that has to be experienced. It can never be adequately explained. Bhagwan uses multiple analogies, and one of them is that of sugar. One can explain how sugar looks, the characteristics, the color, the shape, etc. But nobody can actually say that he or she knows what sugar is unless he or she actually consumes and tastes it. Right. Because taste is something that can never be described. And the vice versa also holds true, because once you have tasted sugar, it doesn't actually matter if you don't know the color, the shape, the characteristics, because when somebody says sugar, you know what it is because you have experienced it. And therefore, quite some time last week we spent on this facet that the ultimate is something that has to be experienced. It is only up to a certain level that we can go via explanation and description. Beyond that, even Swami cannot help, because Swami can only prod us on to make efforts to get that experience. Once we get the experience, it's all done. And Swami also made it clear that though the objective, the avataric mission, is possibly to ensure that everybody has this experience, if we also want to participate in this mission, it has to begin with transformation of the self first, others next, finally the entire world can be looked at. Because if we try to change others without possibly changing ourselves, there is no impact. You know, just going through this, and this will be the theme that goes on also in the conversation that we'll carry out today. The thought that just struck me was, even these things that we consider as high philosophy, you know, we would call them as bouncers in our hostel language, things that go over the head. When we would have some of the elders or teachers possibly explaining this to us, we might not have paid much attention. The same thing when Swami explains it, we pay so much attention. In terms of communicating it, or in terms of the words used, there is not much difference between Swami and the elders or the teachers or even our own classmates when they gave their speeches, because most often they would be quoting Swami himself directly. But why is it that we would listen with interest and eagerness to Swami and not others? I think it simply comes from the fact that Swami is not just telling. His telling is backed by what he is doing, and his doing is backed by what he is. Because he is living that experience, that's why what he speaks makes impact on us. And that is possibly the reason why if we listen to the same words being spoken by our classmates in a class speech, we will not get impressed at all, because possibly the person giving the talk has not got that experience. It is just a theoretical rendition. So also extrapolating the same thing, it is so important that even if we want to participate in Bhagwan's mission of making everyone realize this truth, because Swami says that is the only mission, that is the only Satisai mission, that is the only mission of the Satisai organization or anything that bears the Satisai name, to learn Satya. If we want to participate in that, and even if we think of communicating it, the only way our communication can be effective is if we ourselves be that truth first. And that is why it becomes important that the individual, the transformation begins at the individual level and then spreads outward. This was in brief, I mean, the recap plus an introduction to what will be the conversations between Hislop and Bhagwan in this week's satsang.
And then, the other important thing which the discussion was going about was, I think, Swami referring to what that idea of the self is, because that's how it started by him. You know, he starts by asking, I mean, it all starts with intensity, first of all. That is from the previous fortnight's discussion, when Swami says intensity is important. Then he says, if intensity is there, doesn't this also become another form of greed? And then he says that, you know, when I seek love, am I not, does that love not become separate from me? And then Swami goes on to say, then who are you? Have you understood who you are? And then he tries to say that he is actually an accumulation of his ideas. Then Swami is saying, you are saying my ideas, so who is that my? Who are you referring to? And that's how slowly Swami takes him back, and that's where suddenly Swami says, you know, this has to be experienced, it cannot be explained. And it can be experienced through sadhana done very, very slowly. In fact, very interestingly, I think a couple of weeks back I was listening to a discourse which Swami had given 1973, mm-hmm. where Swami says there are three types of approaches in spirituality. I've never heard that before, so it was very interesting that, and it's such an old discourse. I don't know the exact Sanskrit terminology which Swami uses, but what Swami was referring to is three types of path. One is the path of the bird. I'm sorry, first is the path of the monkey, the path of the bird, and the path of the ant. Mm-hmm. Right? And Swami is saying the path of the monkey is, the monkey climbs a tree and it plucks a fruit, but holding the fruit in the hand, it looks at another fruit and tries to pluck that. So it jumps. So Swami says that it, in the process, it drops what is there in its hand also.
Hmm.
And Swami says some people are after spirituality like this. You know, they have some gains, but they're looking at, you know, they're not happy with it. They're looking at somebody else and saying that, oh, I want to be like that person. I want to raise to that person's, level or whatever it is. And Swami says in the process, whatever you gained also you lose. The little peace of mind and the little focus that you have earned, you lose it. Because now it becomes greed. Even though it's in the path of spirituality, it becomes greed. Then Swami is saying about the second is of the bird. And Swami is saying the bird swoops at the fruit at such vigor that in the process it makes the fruit fall down and it is not able to get the fruit also. So Swami is saying that some people approach spirituality like that. You know, they kind of take on too much more than they can, you know, handle. So Swami says somebody gives you a japmala and the first day itself you sit for 2 hours to do japam. Swami says it doesn't work like that. Start with 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Do that 15 minutes for a few weeks.
Consistently.
Right? And then slowly you increase. You know, don't do it in bursts and spurts, as Swami was saying. And Swami is saying the best is the method of the ant, which does it slowly. And Swami says that, you know, when it finds the truth, it does not gorge on the truth right there. Swami says it carries it along with it. And at its leisure, it keeps munching it over and over and over again. So Swami is saying that is the best path. You do it slowly. You take it at a small bite at a time. Even though it might be a very slow process, Swami is saying that is the best process. And that is what Swami is saying, that an ant can lift weight that's twice its own size because of this ability of the ant, that it is very, very slow. And it you know, it Swami is giving the example of satsang. It does not do it alone. It does it as a community. So there was a very interesting thing that Swami was saying. That's what Swami ends this last week's discussion with, where Swami was talking about sadhana, the importance of sadhana, and doing it for yourself. And Swami says that even your wife, how much ever she loves you, how much ever you love her, she cannot eat for you, you cannot eat for her. Same is the case with spirituality too.
You know, speaking of the ant, I just happened to see it somewhere that the ant apparently can lift 50 times its own weight, which only adds to the wonder and magnificence of following it in this aspect. Continuing with the conversation, Swami says that, you know, when Hislop is asking for more explanation, Swami says that in the beginning, we do not understand the things of the world and do not even understand ourselves. So how can you understand that which is beyond you? So first try to understand yourself by doing spiritual practice, by doing sadhana. First I, next you. I plus you equals V, so then it's V. Then V plus he, then only he. That is when Hislop says, no, I don't understand that. And Swami lovingly explains, first I, then you. First I, that is life. Next you, that is the world. I plus you is we. We plus he is God, only he. There is love, the person who loves, and the person you love. So there is love, the person who loves, and the person who is loved. When all get together, it is bliss. This is how Swami explains to Hislop. And from what we understand here, it becomes obvious that Swami is speaking about transforming the self first through love, and then expanding this circle of transformation to others, and finally enveloping the whole world so that there exists nothing else other than God. This is what Swami would famously refer to in his discourses as expansion love. Swami would say expansion love is life, contraction love is death.
Right, and it's a very interesting equation that Swami is putting forth. As we can see later in the kind of questions that are going to be asked, it's actually a little confusing when you say, because we've heard Swami saying the other way around. You know, Swami would say joy, Jesus first, others next and you last. Mm. Or Sai, you know, where Swami would say Swami first, all others next and I last. But here Swami is saying first I. The way Swami is putting it is slightly different from that. It is not from the point of view of, you know, whom you're giving priority when it comes to helping or giving comfort in that sense. But in the point of view of, as Swami would say, when you want to correct, when you want to transform, when you want to understand, then it becomes the other way around. First you try to do it with yourself, because what is in your control, you first do it. And that's when you are qualified to go beyond what is in your control. And Swami is saying that if that I is perfected, that understanding of I is perfected, Swami says that the amount of influence that you can have on others is unlimited, actually. And that's what we see with all the great masters, and of course even when the avatar comes. When Swami says, the impact of those words are much, much more than, as you were explaining in the beginning, than probably you and I sitting here and explaining in the satsang. Because that's the importance of doing it yourself first before you share it with others.
You know, when you say that, on one hand Swami says God first, others next, I last, and here it is I first and then expand it. As you rightly said, they are absolutely not in contradiction, because in order to ensure God is first, in order to ensure all others are next and I am last, that is a path of selflessness. And as we discussed in the previous week's satsang, selflessness is a divine quality, and that quality can come only when we are close to divinity. And therefore, if we have to be selfless, if we have to give first priority to God, next to everything else, and finally only to myself, if I have to be that selfless, I have to be close to divinity, at least, if not divinity, myself. And therefore, it makes sense that I start first by realizing my own divinity. So they are absolutely in sync, they are complementary. One happens because of the other. One cannot happen without the other. So it is natural that we progress from I to we to he. This is that expansion love, where first you realize that you are divine. First I realize I am divine, and you know, it is not just a theoretical realization. I remember once, you know, in the bhajan hall, I have repeated this many times, Swami was speaking to all of us, members of the Sai Sannidhi, which is the students of Bhagwan who have decided to work for Bhagwan at Prashant Nilayam, Brindavan and other institutions. So, during that interview in the bhajan hall, Swami pitched at a very, very high level. He said that there is nothing like sorrow, there is nothing like happiness. You do not experience sorrow or happiness because you are happiness, you are sorrow. You know, Swami was speaking Advaitam. He said, you are everything. There exists nothing else other than you. That's all it is. So, he emphasized saying that, therefore, don't separate yourself from divine. You are divine. There's nothing else. There's only divinity in the universe. So, when he said all this, you know, I had a doubt and I asked Swami, if I keep saying that I am God, is that not ahankara? Is that not ego? Means, am I not being pompous? That was my thought. Mm-hmm. How will people perceive when I say I am God? Swami said, no, that is not ego. The correct satyam. He said, that is the correct truth. That is the only truth, that I am God. And immediately after that, you know, because, see, that is the beauty of Bhagwan. While he gives us the profound truths, he also gives the practical aspects. He said that is the absolute truth, that is not ego. But then he also gave a practical way to look at it. He said, but that doesn't mean you say, I am God, and do whatever nonsense that you wish to do.
Mm-hmm.
Even as he said that, everybody laughed aloud. And then Swami lovingly patted on the head and said, no, see, understand. When you are God, just see, you will, when you get some thoughts which are even slightly, they need not be negative thoughts, they are slightly less positive than the ultimate, you yourself will feel, hey, will God do this? God will not do this. Cha-cha. And you will automatically not do it. That way, if you are leading, then okay. And I feel the most easy way to understand that is, will Swami do this? Will Swami have done this? You know, when somebody criticizes me, I feel like giving back a piece of my mind, possibly. But if I think of how Swami would respond, if I sincerely, even theoretically, I am trying to practice the concept that I am God, it's best to equate myself with this thought as to how will Swami respond to this. If somebody, you know, criticized Swami, Swami would respond in his action. He would give love to that person also. He would, in fact, shower so much love that person gets overwhelmed. You know, he's almost shamed into loving Bhagwan, because he'll feel that I have given so much of negative and what I'm getting back is so positive. And that is the way I think we have to go about developing our own, individual transformation. Once we are to some certain extent firm in that I am God, then we can start seeing God in everyone else. And finally, as Swami says, you move from I to we, and from we to he. Finally, there is nothing like me and others. It's only God, God, God. That is, I think that is theoretically the Advaitic experience.
And the last sentence of that thing is very, very beautiful, where Swami says, first I, next you. I think maybe it has to be read together. It's not like first I and then you. It is first I, next you, is where Swami says, when there is probably absence of any, the emotion of love or attachment between the two, I'm actually first thinking of myself and I'm seeing you as distinct from me. Mm-hmm. Then Swami says, I plus you equals we. And that's where then you actually start looking at it as, as one person, like what happens in a family, what happens, you know, when you're married or when you have children. You do not see them as distinct from yourself. You know, when you're thinking of what is best for you, you're actually thinking of what is best for everybody else.
Mm.
So automatically, Swami says there, that love aspect comes. And then he says, then we plus he becomes only he. And when that, again, Swami would say this many, many times. It's, you know, when you show love towards people around you in the form of your family or your friends, it's not that when that same love turns to God, it's a different kind of love. It's the same love, actually. Now it turns to God. But when that love turns to God, it becomes bhakti. And once bhakti comes into the picture, it has the ability to melt away all the differences. And that's why Swami explains here so beautifully that, you know, when he says, first I, then you, first I, that is life, right? Mm-hmm. What Swami had told in the last week, you're all the time trying to protect yourself, which is the essence of life itself. And then Swami says, next you, that is the world. I plus you is we. We plus he is God. Only he. There is love. The person who loves and the person you love. And we all get together in a bliss. So it's that once that moment, the moment that love comes and that love turns towards God, it has the ability to remove all the differences in between. And Swami would again give that example of the mirror which is there in between, you know, 3 minus 1 in spirituality is equal to 1, Swami would say. Where you have the mirror, you have the reflection and you have the person. The moment you remove any one of it, there's only one. The third one vanishes automatically. And I mean, when we talk about doing this as a sadhana, it's quite complicated to talk of it. But when Swami says that as you do it as a sadhana, you'll understand it. And recall, I think one of our, another colleague who's a Sai Sanidhi member, he was sharing with us. You know, he's into this. He reads a lot of Upanishads. In fact, he's written commentaries on Upanishads and all that. So in a Kode session, he asked Swami, that Swami, I want self-realization, he said. And Swami looked at him very seriously and Swami said, I will not give you. And you know, I will not help you or something like that, Swami said. And he was taken aback because he thought that was the ultimate thing that you can ask Swami instead of asking all the worldly things which people are, you know, occupying Swami with. Mm-hmm. And probably asking the ultimate thing and Swami is refusing downright like that. So he was a little, puzzled by Swami's answer. And then Swami explained to him. Swami said, see, self-realization, you have to work for it. I can help you, I can guide you, but I will not give it to you. You have to work for it. And I think that is the thing. I mean, how much ever we reread this line over and over again, I think only to an extent we'll be able to understand that.
See, it reminds me of what Swami would often tell in his discourses, that for the current to flow, you need the positive and the negative. And Swami would say, God's grace is the positive. Your effort is the negative. Both have to come together. Then only that current flows. I mean, the way we have pictured liberation or moksha is like it is something that happens in a moment. Because whether we even take others, you know, others who have been enlightened, say Gautam Buddha, Mahavira, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, or Tiruvannamalai, Ramana Maharshi, they have been putting effort for a long period of time. But that moment of realization or enlightenment happens in a flash, in an instant. That also Swami explains in his discourses about how it's like a room is dark for centuries. But the moment you put on the switch, in a moment, the darkness is gone. It's not as if like the darkness that existed for centuries needs equal number of centuries to get into light. One moment is enough. And that is why Swami says, His grace, the positive, it's always there. It's always there, you know, waiting. The moment the negative terminal, that is that of our effort, touches, there is that electric flow. There is that current that flows. That is why possibly Swami says that even Swami can't give. Swami can only be like the positive, hold the current ready. You have to be ready to receive it. Then only there is that discharge of current that happens. And I think that is the best way to understand why is it that Swami can't give. Swami can't give in the sense because there has to be this negative terminal also to receive. The process of giving necessarily requires a giver and a receiver. If there is no receiver, then there is no giving. That is what Swami is saying by, you know, that even Swami cannot confer that on you. You have to put in effort. At the same time, let us realize that without Swami's grace, there is no way we can get it, how much ever we put in effort. And that is something, again, we discussed last week as to how, you know, that Pranipatena Pariprashnena Sevaya, that stanza in the Jnana Yoga of Bhagavad Gita, which says that to become a Jnani, finally, you have to humbly serve and seek from another self-realized soul, because when the time is right, it is that Jnani who will confer Jnana on you. So both are needed.
Actually, in fact, in a discourse, Swami makes this very, very clearly. He says, now you're all in Dvaita. Swami says, with much effort, you can go from Dvaita to Vishishta Dvaita. But Vishishta Dvaita to Advaita, Swami said, you'll need only God's grace. Seeing your effort, God confers that on you. And it's not like with your effort, you can get there. And I don't know, I think we must have quoted this. There was this we have this altar making competition in Vrindavan and even in Prashant Nilayam. Mm-hmm. But I think it's Janmashtami time we make altars in the room, right?
Correct.
And they're all judges come around and they give you marks and there's
they make it a competition too.
Right, competition is declared. In earlier years, of course, the altars used to be placed in the Kalyan Mandapam and Swami used to come and bless all the altars and all that. So, there'll be some rooms where the artistic talent is lacking quite a bit, right? And they used to come up with some weird idea and they would get the dimensions wrong and they would get some things could go totally all right.
They would make up for lack of artistic talent with their philosophical ability.
Right, exactly. And that's precisely what happened in this room where they'd made a very pretty decent looking structure and they wanted to make steps leading to the altar, right? And in the last minute, in the hurry, they made the steps, but it was not reaching up to the altar, right? And there was a small gap between the
The floor and the
and the last flight of steps, right? And it was clearly a design flaw. So when the judges came around and they'll usually ask, what is the philosophy behind your altar and all that, and these guys give some story of what they thought of, which would never be what it is actually. And then one of the judges asked, why is there a gap between the steps and the altar? And spontaneously that student said, sir, the ultimate cannot be reached by our effort. through your effort you can come till the last step and then God's grace lifts you to the altar.
Did the altar win the competition?
And I'm sure the comment won the hearts of the judges at least.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of expansion love, I just came across this passage. It's from the discourse that Bhagwan delivered on the occasion of Deepavali in the year 1970. So we don't have the audio and therefore I'll just read out. It's a little big passage, but it makes it very clear as to what is meant by expansion love and what is love, what is expansion. Swami says, expansion is love. Expansion is the essence of love. Love is God, live in love. This is the Deepavali message I give you. When a lamp is lit from another, there are two where there was but one in the beginning. The first one did not stop emitting light. In this way you can light a million lamps from one, but yet the first one will not suffer a jot. Love too is like this. Share it with a million. It will still be as bright as it was when it was alone. There is another lesson too, which is the illumination on Deepavali day tend to teach. Each house in the street lights a few lamps and keeps them on the doorsill, the parapet wall, the gate, the porch, the well. And what is the effect? The town is filled with light. The residents are happy and the children dance in glee. And the sky shines in the glow of earthly joy. Light spreads. It mingles with the light from other sources of light. It has no boundaries, no prejudices, no favorites. You may not like your neighbor, but the light from the lamp on your veranda shines hand in hand with the light from the lamp on his veranda. You cannot keep it back. Deepavali is intended to teach you this lesson of light and love. Move out, clasp, spread, expand, give up limits of mine and thine, his and theirs, caste and creed, in one limitless flow of love. That is the culmination of all spiritual sadhana. I think on that occasion of Deepavali, so beautifully Swami explains by equating love with light, how light is something that never diminishes how much ever it is spread. That is a quality of this expansion love. And that is why you can be sure that it is love if it expands. If you say that light, I have light, but the moment I give you that light, my light will go and I can't share it. You can be sure that you are talking of something else using the term light. Because light is something that as it spread, it only grows and it never diminishes. You never lose the light in spite of, as Swami says, how many of our lamps you light. In the same way also, if I feel that my love is restricted to myself, possibly my family, it is not possible for me to love everyone because it's not possible, it's not humanly possible, then the love that Swami is referring to and the love we are referring to is absolutely different. That becomes very clear and that is how, Swami defines love itself. Love is something that is infinite. It grows as you spread it more and more and therefore it makes sense that you spread it. Therefore, expansion is love. Expansion itself is love. I think this is such a nice way to understand whenever we think of love, whether it is the divine love or not. Because many times we think of love in terms of friendship, love in terms of a spouse, love in terms of mother. And as Swami says, all of them have got different names, Vatsalyam and Sneham and different things. They are all, yes, subsets of love, but they alone cannot define love. Love is defined only by its quality of expansion. And this was one clip, one excerpt from Bhagwan's discourse in the 1970 Deepavali day.
The other thing, if you look at it, actually, looking at the broader picture of from where someone like Dr. Hislop is coming, it always helps to go back to his background of speaking about Advaita, speaking about the intellectual understanding of these spiritual concepts, which are so native to Vedantic philosophy. Probably you never speak about love in that context. Whenever you're speaking about, when you read any of the Upanishads, one of the Vedam students in our university was once saying, it's very difficult to come across a word for love in the Vedas, in Vedanta. It actually never speaks about love as much as it speaks of all the other concepts. It speaks about the self, it speaks about illumination, but there is no word prema or any other word for love in the Vedanta when it's speaking of all these concepts. But so beautifully, Swami brings in the concept of love here, because Swami is first telling him, see, you have to understand who you are. Now, Swami is asking, who are you? He's saying that I am all these ideas. Swami says, you have to understand who you are. And then Swami is saying that you cannot understand who you are without you understanding that you are a drop in the ocean. And that can be understood only when you understand yourself, you understand that you are, in combination with all those around, and all of you put together is God. And when you completely sublimate your individuality in your love for God, that's when it's complete Advaita. It's not just you understanding that you are this, you are that, or you even claiming that I am the Supreme. So Swami gives that growth so beautifully in that one sentence.
As you said, there might be no prema in Vedanta, but there's a lot of Vedanta in prema. Very
but,
nicely
that's,
put.
That's the beautiful thing, that Swami's first vahini was actually prema vahini. Mm-hmm. And in prema vahini, Swami speaks very little about prema. Because the thing is, as one of the boys who were doing this prema vahini satsang, they themselves were saying, see, when Swami named that vahini prema vahini, I think even G.V. sir was referring to this. Mm-hmm. It is not that Swami is talking about love. It is that whatever Swami is talking is out of his love. And that's why the first vahini was named prema vahini. Because it is a flow of love. It is a flow of his love. It might speak of philosophy and Vedanta, but it is out of his love that he is doing it. So I think that is what is seen here. So very patiently Swami is explaining it to him. And it can be clearly seen as a shift of themes, as we saw in the first chapter itself and the subsequent chapters. The clear shift of themes, and here also Swami is saying that you have to understand it, you have to speak of sadhana, and from sadhana there's a sudden jump to love, and then we're going to see another jump also after this.
I think at this point in time, before we take the jump, we'll take a quick little break, because after the break, we will take that apparent jump, but as we shall see later on, even that jump, it's almost like as we are building up a jigsaw puzzle, we start off at one point and we are building it up. Suddenly we might start at the other, because it's convenient to build that way. Any one of us who has solved the jigsaw puzzle would have seen that's what is happening. We start from possibly the left lower corner. After building up for some time, we go to the right top corner and start building from there. And then as we start building from all sides, it converges. And mostly the centerpiece is one of the last pieces to be put to complete the jigsaw puzzle. That is how Bhagwan is also building this up. So, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break, and on the other side of the break, continue this discussion.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were at the point where Swami spoke about how one has to move from I to we to we to he, and the concept of expanding one's idea of oneself through love and eventually devotion, where Swami said that devotion will sublimate all individuality and differences, and one is focused only on God in that point. And that's where the explanation was last when we stopped last. We'll continue with what Swami was explaining, because Swami goes on after that. He says further, he says, these are Swami's words. You see, there are three blades in the fan. The three gunas are represented by the three blades. Only when the blades circulate together in harmony do you get the air. When they move in the same direction, then they bring the cool air. The three gunas within us are going in different directions. When you turn them in the same direction, all going around together, then you will have one-pointedness and you will be enabled to know. So these are Swami's words. Continuation, and as we said, there's a apparent jump in the theme as Swami is speaking.
But you know, as we had also hinted at the way the jigsaw puzzle is being built, if we think a little bit, we come up with, Swami inspires in us an understanding that makes so much sense. You know, Swami was explaining about how it is so important to have self-transformation, that we have to first become divine, we have to realize our identity, possibly first at an intellectual level and then experience it. Without it, it's of no use. And now Swami is going into the nuts and bolts of how to experience it. You know, we all know that the entire creation, each one of us, is a combination of these three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. Sattva stands for purity, goodness, virtue. Rajas stands for passion, energy, you know, even anger comes under rajas. And tamas stands for sloth. So, we had seen how every being is a combination of these three in different proportions. In some the sattva dominates, in some the rajas dominates, in some the tamas dominates. And in our ancient scriptures, those in which the tamas dominated were called as the rakshasas, those asuras, those in which the sattva dominated were devas and sages and saints. So in this way, everything is but an interplay of these three gunas. Now, Swami says, but these three gunas have to be in harmony. And this is how, dear listeners, we understand it. It is like, though the gunas stand for purity, passion and sloth, they should be united in their motivation to realize the ultimate. For instance, when I say purity, why am I being pure? Why am I being pure in my mind and thought? The motivation should be that I want to please my Swami. And not because I want to earn merit, I will earn punyam, because of which I will be able to enjoy later on. Because when I say that I want to be pure so that I earn punyam and I enjoy later on, then my motivation is enjoyment of the world. While here, in the first case, my motivation is to please God. In a similar way, rajoguna, though it is said it is passion and energy, that passion and energy can be for doing Bhagwan's tasks, the way Hanuman did. You know, as Swami would tell in his discourses, Rama never told Hanuman, you burn Lanka and come back. But it was the rajoguna in Hanuman that made Hanuman burn the entire Lanka and then he came back to Rama. But that is appreciated. In fact, the Sundara Kandam is sung and his glories are sung. It is said that he was able to do what the Lord wanted him to do without even the Lord having to tell him what should be done. So, when rajoguna is also focused towards God, it becomes wonderful when the focus is God. Instead of me having passion and energy for other worldly stuff, for relationships, for money, career, if it is towards pleasing Swami, yes, we do seva amazingly, we do bhajans amazingly, and who doesn't get spiritually uplifted during a very energetic and awesome bhajan session? So that is rajoguna. And even tamoguna, sloth. See, I may be ready to use my rajoguna to overcome tamoguna and do bhajan throughout the night during an akhand bhajan. But on any other day, say my friends are saying, come, let's go out, there's a fantastic movie at 9 o'clock. I say, no, I want to sleep. And they'll tell, don't be so slothful, you're sleeping at 9. That is what I feel is the way we direct tamoguna towards Swami, because I'm using tamas in a manner so that I'm at my best early in the morning during Brahma Muhurtam, because I want to utilize the time meditating about Swami. When you are actually going to be sleeping, I will be thinking about God, and in order to ensure that I can do that during Brahma Muhurtam, I will sleep off by 9, 9:30. Again, this is my understanding, not that I follow this 100% to the letter and spirit, but this is our effort. And that is why Swami says, when all, it is not possible that everybody is absolutely only sattva guna. Finally, Swami says, you have to overcome all the three gunas and go beyond. But even before that, we have to become fully sattva. But even before becoming that sattva, Swami says, like how the three blades of the fan move in harmony and blow cool air, in the same way, if the sattva, rajas and tamas in each one of us are in harmony with a common motivation and goal, then we will be able to achieve success. And this is from a spiritual viewpoint. The same holds good from a worldly viewpoint also. Even if I want to be successful, say in a career or in a relationship or any other thing, I need all these three gunas of mine to work in harmony. But Swami is clearly saying that it is best to make them work in harmony for a spiritual goal, because as we discussed the previous weeks, it is only a spiritual goal that will give us permanent peace and happiness that we are craving for. None of the others gives. And therefore have that spiritual goal, and for that, ensure that the sattva, rajo and tamo, the three blades of the fan within us, don't turn in their own directions but work in harmony.
In fact, you know, when we were doing that satsang on, I think the hostel schedules, we had played those discourses where Swami was talking about what time you wake up and all that. And Swami was clearly saying in that you know, at one point he said, you know, you wake up at 4:30, don't wake up earlier than that. Swami is saying some people have the habit of waking up at 3 o'clock. Swami is saying that much also is not required. Sleep well, because the body needs sleep. Swami was saying that, you know, when you acknowledge that tamoguna also has to be in harmony, it is your acknowledgement that, you know, this body is made out of matter. And Swami would say, I think in some of the discourses, when Swami speaks about the concept of panchikritam, he says that's how the world comes into existence. Swami says it is the activity of tamas on the elements which has caused matter. So Swami is saying that when you come into a human form which is made of this body, which is material, it has a certain amount of tamas. There is a certain amount you can push the body, certain amount you have to give it rest. So Swami was saying that, you know, you need to give it that rest, you give it that rest. At the same time, activity. And Swami was giving that example of how from morning 8 o'clock to, I think, afternoon 4, right? That's what Swami was saying, is the time when the body is supposed to be kept active. At that time, you have to make it do activity. And that's why Swami would say, even discourage to an extent the idea of renunciation. Swami was saying that, no, the body is meant for doing karma. And that is why I think even in the order of monks and all that, they do not tell you that you can sit quiet. You know, you're supposed to do activity. You're supposed to keep yourself active. And similarly, when you talk about sattva, I think what Swami would say, the idea that you need to be sattvic only when you come to a Sai center, or you have to be sattvic only when you're going for bhajans or when you enter a temple, that's not it is. That quality of sattva should be with you all the time. You know, that idea of purity, that idea of calmness and sereneness is something that has to be in you even when probably you're in the middle of activity. That's what was the advice Krishna gives Arjuna. He says, you know, ma anusmara yudhyacha, he says, you think of me all the time, you keep doing namasmarana and you go and fight the battle, he says. So even when you're in the peak of activity, it does not mean your sattva quotient is actually coming down. You know, you're supposed to keep thinking of God even when you're in the peak of activity. And as you rightly said, even the activities of tamas are supposed to be regulated by the desire to probably, you know, wake up in the next morning, be fresh enough for the Brahma Muhurtam and fresh enough for the day of activity also. So that is what regulates your tamas, and your tamas regulates your activity, and all through the sattva is permeating all your actions and all your rest as well.
It's almost like the different ingredients you use while cooking. Yeah, you cannot enjoy food without salt. At the same time, too much of salt ruins the food. So there needs to be a harmony. All the three are necessary, and that is what Swami explains. At this point in time, actually, Swami is interrupted by one member in the interview room, possibly, whom Hislop calls as a visitor, and the visitor says, could it be like this? It is the experience of a number of people, including myself, that gradually one does sadhana. But then comes such an experience that would have taken an immense time to gain. But through your grace, one has this sudden experience. You know, so he's trying to understand whether, you know, by listening to Swami, when I'm doing sadhana, will it happen that whatever I'm supposed to get normally by sadhana, it will get accelerated and accentuated. I will get it faster. Is that what you are trying to tell, Swami? He asks. And Swami responds with another example. Swami says, another example. In a house, each one does a particular job and divides the work. In the evening, when the family has finished the work, nobody says, Father, I did such and such a work, you must pay me this much. It is one house. So you don't ask for payment, you just do the work. But when someone from outside comes, you fix up the rate and pay accordingly. When you pay them, that shows that they are outsiders. But when they become your own, you don't have to pay them. They work with interest and no pay is expected. Similarly with God. When you think God is the nearest and dearest to you, like one family, you don't ask for pay. The one who surrenders like that, he is my own. He does not have to look for payment. But the one who says, I have done so much sadhana and barters with God and says, I have done so much sadhana, you must give me such and such a reward. Then that is the difference. He is the outsider. So, you know, it's indirectly an answer to when he's saying that, when he's asking the question as to Swami, if I work as per what Swami says, will I achieve my spiritual reward faster? This is Swami's response.
I mean, this wide variety of things that Swami is covering here. I mean, just talking about what Swami said about the three gunas. You know, initially starting with the idea of who am I, you know, almost that was the thing which Swami spoke about. I mean, even before that, the starting was the difference between reality and imagination, and difference between truth and reality. And then how do you understand that? Swami said you have to do sadhana, you'll have to work on it little by little. And then Swami goes on to explain this concept of, I to we, to we to he, where love comes into play. And then Swami speaking about the harmony between the three gunas, which essentially means that, you know, it is not that you become a spiritual person and you become a person who does not do any action. You continue to do action, you continue to do your duty, and that's what Swami says. And now going back to the idea of sadhana itself, Swami is saying sadhana as an expression of what you are, not as sadhana as a means of achieving something. And this is again taking into the next level, because it again goes back to the question which Hislop was asking about, doesn't this become another form of greed? You know, I'm striving to earn money, and now I'm saying I'm striving to earn something which God's is a grace, spiritual benefit or God's grace or elevation in my spiritual status or whatever it is. And Swami gives this beautiful concept, which is again a very, very fundamental Vedantic concept. We would have heard Swami saying this, that he would say you are Nush, that verse from the Vedas which Swami would quote, Shrunvantro Vishve Amritasya Putra, Swami would say that you are
children of immortality.
Children of immortality, which means immortality is your, you know, it belongs to you by heredity. It's not something you have to earn. But still, in the house, you're meant to do some work. It's almost like that. You know, you're supposed to help your parents. You're supposed to, if your father has a shop, by default, you go and work in the shop. It does not mean that you earn your father's property. Your father's property will eventually come to you. But, you know, this is what you're meant to do. This is the duty, your duty bound to do this. And Swami is literally saying the sadhana that you do is not necessarily what you earn as a spiritual benefit is a reward for the sadhana.
You're not a worker at home.
Yes. Right. You know, you are going to get that by heredity. It's your property by birth. But
by right, yes.
Yeah, but the sadhana that you do will, you know, enable you to enjoy that even before probably you get it full-fledged. You know, it becomes yours.
It's very interesting because during another such Sai Sanidhi meet, Bhagwan said, Seva is your hakku, service is your right. So when we look at that with this perspective at home, it is my right to do the thing, you know. For example, for instance, now one of the rooms in our home is getting painted, and the painters are supposed to clean all the extra drops or whatever mess they have made. But when they didn't do it, the maid servant who comes home is supposed to do it. Because one is we are paying the painters, one is we are paying the maid servant. But when she didn't do last night, me and my wife quickly cleaned it up. Nobody's paying me and my wife, and we are not even expecting it because it's our house. The whole thing is ours. You know, it makes so much sense. It is our right. It is our right to do the work there because it is mine. So it makes such a paradigm shift when we are doing sadhana, because most often than not in sadhana also we become like daily wage earners. Not even standard blue-collar employees like ourselves or white-collar employees. It's not like we are looking at a monthly salary also. We did something, we want reward. We did something, we want reward. We become like daily wage earners. Swami is saying, don't be like daily wage earners. Don't even be like employees. Be like masters, because you are the masters of the house. You are going to inherit this. Whole thing is yours. And when you do sadhana, It is with the feeling, the way you do work at home, that you do sadhana. And it makes everything so clear. It doesn't need further explanation. And I feel we are only adding more redundant sentences to express our own excitement and enthusiasm at what we have learned. But Swami shows so clearly that when you are doing sadhana, it is like you are doing your own homework. That's it. There is joy in just doing it because it's your home. That's all. In the same way, you are already the one to inherit this entire wisdom, entire divinity, everything. It's already yours. There's nothing. You're just doing it as, you know, without any expectation of any reward happening or anything coming. So, this is, I think, what Bhagwan Krishna also told Arjuna, that you do this pavitra karma, the karma falatyaga, do it without expectation of the fruit. Just do it because it's your duty to do it. That is what Swami is explaining here, and it also makes it very clear that there's nothing like a spiritual greed, as Hislop had asked. Hislop had asked, I have a material greed and you're asking me to replace it with a spiritual greed. And Swami says, no, don't replace it with spiritual greed. Replace it with just spirituality. There is no greed, there is no expectation when you work at home. That is the way you have to do sadhana. When sadhana is done in the right way, there is no expectation. So it is not greed at all. It is like one's nature to do just as one does for one's own family.
Right, and then Swami further explains that with another example. He says, the child who is so small does not ask the mother, I want milk, I want to be changed, and so on. But the mother looks after every need of the child without its asking. When you have surrendered yourself completely to God and become God's child, you don't have to tell God what you want. He will give even more than you have asked for. But it is only by love that He is your dearest. Do sadhana and there is a closeness to God. Then you don't have to tell Him that you want this or that. Because you are like a little child, He will come and give you more than even what you ask for. Ego is what prevents us from becoming close to God. It is that ego, I have to do this, I have to get all this. You must see that I is only the instrument of the Lord. Like the fan is an instrument, you are an instrument of the Lord. Now, is the fan making the fan rotate or is the current making the fan rotate? And Hislop answers, the current is making the fan rotate.
Of course, Swami has shifted over to another theme there. But before we go to that, I want to go back to that, revisit that point where Swami is telling about the child who says, I want milk. And Swami says that if you are like that child, you will be given more than what you need also. I remember we had this afternoon satsang discussion on, do we seek Swami for Swami or for the wonders of His hand? I think it's part of a famous Christmas carol or a Christmas song, mm-hmm. where we have come to seek your face, not the wonders of your hand, is one line. And we had made a satsang on this particular theme. As to, are we seeking Swami because He fulfills our desires, He fulfills our wishes, or we are seeking Swami because we seek Swami and He happens to fulfill our desires? You know, I was watching a documentary on the life of the great painter Pablo Picasso.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, every person, every genius, everyone has his positives and negatives. And Pablo Picasso had more than one marriage. He was married 2-3 times. And in one instance, you know, there is this lady painter who comes to learn painting from him. She actually wants, and she's, when Picasso asks her, what do you want? She says that, you know, I am a big fan of yours. I admire you. I want to be with you. That's the way. So when she comes to learn from him, he doesn't teach her anything, you know. He doesn't teach her anything, and it's very strange. And at the end of some time, she's really upset. And she asks, what is this? Why are you doing this to me? I mean, I'm not getting anything from you. And Picasso says, that's exactly the reason. You didn't come for me. You came to improve your own art. So I'm not going to get nothing. You know, he brutally sends her away. And later on, actually, it is the same woman who becomes one of his, I don't know, third or fourth wife, whatever. She becomes, and at that time, you know, she's truly in love with Picasso.
Mm-hmm.
And she just comes and says, I love you, I want to be with you. So it is at that point in time, you know, Picasso, unasked, starts conferring on her so many ideas, so many skills, so many things, and she starts developing into a great artist herself. You know, it just struck me that many times we also, I mean, it's not a very apt explanation just because it was a documentary that I recently saw off the top of my mind, I'm saying, but many times we come to Swami like that. Though we say, Swami, we love you, you know, you are the most important in our life, it's because we feel that only He has the capacity to sort the mess in my life, or, you know, pull me out of the financial situation or improve my relationship status somewhere. We camouflage our selfishness for fulfilling some worldly desire by saying, Swami, we love you. And mostly when that problem gets solved, we actually forget God. That is why only in times of distress we remember Swami. Because we come to Swami seeking things other than Swami. And if man who is selfish by nature himself can wait for, you know, can seek somebody to seek only him and then only give, what to speak of God who is absolutely selfless? He gives. That's why Swami says, in the beginning, I give you what you seek, so that someday you come to seek what I have come to give, which is myself. Swami would tell us students how many times, students, you don't realize what you are having with you. You are seeking other things. You think that many VIPs come to Bhagwan, and therefore you can use Swami's influence and get a good job, you can get a good career. It's not as if Swami spoke this directly, but this is how I would perceive Swami's pain. You think this is what you can get. You are being foolish, because with Bhagwan you can get the ultimate. I have come to grant you the ultimate experience. Don't be foolish of going to the Kalpa Vriksha and asking for coffee powder. You can ask for the ultimate, and don't settle for anything less than the ultimate.
You know, this whole series which Swami is talking about, because first Swami spoke about intensity. Swami said you have to be as intense as you are in the rest of your pursuits. You have to be towards spirituality. It cannot be a casual pursuit. And then Swami is saying that after intensity, Swami is saying you should have this ability to not seek. This ability to not want it and then seek. You know, this is very, very similar to what Swami says in the Dhyanavahini, as you know, we've heard in Swami's other discourses also, where the three stages of meditation or the three stages of sadhana itself, it can be spoken of, where Swami is saying concentration, contemplation and meditation. Swami explains this very beautifully. Swami says that concentration comes from intensity. That when you say that I want to take up to a spiritual path, because as we spoke of in the last couple of sessions, where you've got the vairagyam for the world, you've got bugged up of the world, you've got detached from the world, and so you're looking for something higher, that will give you the intensity of concentration. And Swami is saying from concentration, when you have to go to contemplation, that has to come without the eye on what is the result. Only then you will go to contemplation. And that's where Swami would say that contemplation becomes very, very easy in the context of meditation. Swami would say this when there is love. Swami would say when you're sitting and trying to concentrate on one particular form or one particular name, you know, that intensity is required. But if that concentration has to transcend to contemplation, it will happen when you're doing that smarana or thinking out of love, where that moment itself is a reward. Right? You know, when you start thinking of, when you're sitting in bhajans and you're thinking of Swami, you will find that you have actually lost contact with the world outside. You're probably thinking of a darshan when Swami is walking around, or a moment when Swami spoke to you, or a moment when you saw Swami for the first time.
That
you,
in itself is the reward,
right?
Yes.
You find that, first of all, you've detached from the surroundings. You're not at all thinking of what the others are doing, what the others are thinking. Swami is saying that is the first step of contemplation, where you have lost contact with the world outside. You're contemplating so spontaneously, and you're doing it out of love, and you're not saying that, now I'm contemplating, now I'll get a reward for this. No, you're feeling that that itself is a reward. Swami would say that that is the stage of contemplation, and Swami would explain that when you're able to stay in that state of contemplation for an extended period of time, that's when the, you know, the one who meditates, the one who is meditated upon, and the act of meditation itself merges. That's what Swami was saying, that when that, you know, we to he, it's only he. It is not we and he, or we merging in he. Swami says only the he remains. So that's the third stage. That's why it appears like there is a discord between this, you know, be intense to do sadhana as a child who's working at the home without any reward in mind. But actually that's the stage which happens, and it happens through love, as Swami has beautifully explained in Dhyanavahini.
On that note, dear listeners, we will take another quick little break, and after that, come and conclude this week's satsang.
ब्रह्म सनातन मंगल
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were discussing a conversation between Hislop and other devotees and Bhagwan, and we read out one part of what Swami had answered about the child who is so small and wants milk from the mother. In that flow, Swami also mentioned another part which ended with a question. Swami said that you must see that the eye is only the instrument of the Lord. Like the fan is an instrument, you are also an instrument of the Lord. Then Swami asks, Now is the fan making the fan rotate, or is the current making the fan rotate? And Hislop answers, the current is making the fan rotate. Swami says, the current is God. So you are only the instrument. Even the fact that we think that our eyes see things and that our ear hears things is not correct. My eyes are here, but my mind is in Bangalore thinking of this or that. My eyes are seeing, but my mind is somewhere else. The mind is important. Body is like a torch. Eye is like the bulb. Mind is the battery cell. Intelligence is the switch. Only when the four work together do you get light. The body is only like the torch. So, Swami makes it very clear that ego is what prevents us from becoming close to God because of our wrong identification. The body is just, as Swami says, is like a torch. And we think that the eyes are seeing, but you know, yesterday you were speaking about that, was it Upanishad, where he asked,
right,
what is it
Kino
that
Upanishad.
What is it that makes the eye see, the ears hear? So even scientifically, it is not the eye that is seeing. The eye is just the hardware. There is the optic nerve that carries the signals, and it's a part of the brain that sees.
And exactly, they say the image the eye captures is that of an inverted image, as
yes,
we
absolutely
study in optics. Mm. It's only the processing in the brain which makes it, you know, it makes it, straightens it, and it gives the idea of size also, which and distance.
No, so many things. In fact, you know, these things are available on the internet very easily. You can just search for them, optical illusions, wherein, you know, there is this color that appears, say, orange, and the same thing is shown in the setting with other colors by its side, and it looks, say, green. And they ask you whether that green and this orange are the same. And you say, no, this is green, that is orange. But the moment you just remove the surrounding colors, they both become the same. So, you know, our perception of color itself depends on what is around. It's almost the case of tell me your company, I'll tell you what you are. So it is not the fault of the hardware mechanism, the eye. It is the way the brain perceives and constructs. So it is very, very clear, even from a scientific point of view, that the eyes are just an instrument. The seer is someone else. And that is what Swami is saying. Therefore, the mind becomes so important. See, now in Swami's analogy, Swami says the body is the torch. The eye is like the bulb. But the torch and the bulb get their energy from the battery, which is the mind, Swami says. But even for that power of the battery to be supplied to the bulb, you need a switch. And that switch is the intelligence. Swami says the intellect is that switch. It decides to focus the mind to focus the energy into the bulb, that is, focus the mind to the eye. Otherwise, as Swami says, many times it happens, we are sitting with glazed eyes. That is what our teachers would, you know, tell us, stop daydreaming. Because we are sitting in the class, our eyes are on the blackboard, but nothing is registering because our mind is wandering elsewhere. So that is what happens. So even though the eye is there, the body is there, nothing is, the mind, we are not able to see anything because the mind is elsewhere. So that's what Swami says here. The body is the torch, the eye is the bulb, mind is the power source, and intellect is the switch.
And as Swami is talking about the intelligence, it's again an overtone of what Swami spoke about, the difference between reality and imagination. Because as they would say, you know, when you're sleeping, the eyes are there, the mind is there, and everything which makes you see is still there. And I mean, there are some people who have this habit of sleeping with their eyes open or half open.
Mm-hmm.
But even they will not be able to see what is happening in front of them because the intelligence is actually switched off. You know, when you're sleeping, your intelligence is not awake to your surroundings. That's why your mind might go around. And that's where that kala, karma, kartavya and karanam, Swami was talking about. Those are all which aspects which constitute what we refer to as reason, what we refer to as logic. So that is what is absent in the state of dream, because of which even what is happening in front of you, you're not able to see. And that's why Swami gives this beautiful example of the intelligence being the switch, where everything may be intact, but if the switch is turned off, or when you're asleep, or when you're, you know, in deep sleep state, you will not be able to see what is in front of you. So Swami is giving the whole example of what is this body and what is this personality which is actually operating and what is seeing and experiencing what is happening.
It's almost as if now hearing all this, Hislop is coming to some kind of a conclusion. So he begins by saying, surrender to God is everything, of course. But, and we don't know what he had in mind after that, because Swami cuts him there and Swami says the word surrender in English is not quite correct. It is not the right word, because when you say surrender, you are separate, God is separate. That is the meaning you get, but God is not separate. It's at this point in time that a visitor, you know, again pops up this question. He says the word surrender is not the correct word. So a self-realization, and Swami continues, self-realization, that is why they call it so. You are you. You realize your own self. You are you, not your wife. You are you. That is when a second visitor says, where is our responsibility? we are supposed to share to help others. And a third visitor says, help oneself first. You know, there is a satsang going on there also in the interview room. That is when, you know, Swami says that self is the base or foundation. Help, which is others, is the wall. God is the roof or top of the building. So, Swami constructs this mansion of self-realization. Often Swami would, in his discourses, construct this mansion of self-realization by saying that self-confidence is the foundation, self-satisfaction is the walls, self-sacrifice is the roof, and what you get is the mansion of self-realization. The same mansions, now Swami is building it from another perspective. He says, self, your own, you know, your own progress, that is the base. Help is the wall, and God is the roof. And with this also you get the mansion of self-realization.
So literally Swami is drawing a parallel, because he's talking about self of surrender, and the topic is going off to self-realization. So the reason I think why Swami is saying the word surrender is not the right is because we all mean English word. I think Swami has said this on other occasions also.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where surrender means it is like you're saying that you are superior to me and I am submitting to you, or, you know, I am bowing down to you. Swami is saying it's not that. It is nothing but the recognition that you and I are one. Swami would say that that is the ultimate surrender. And Swami would say this, surrender happens only when the body consciousness is absolutely gone, which means the individuality dissolves into surrender. And that's what Swami is trying to explain here, saying that it is not surrender, it is actually another form of self-realization itself.
Absolutely. And in that self-realization also, Swami makes it very clear that it has to begin with self-help. This is like common sense actually, because even, you know, when you go on flights, when those attendants in the air do the preliminary and compulsory coaching, you know, in the beginning, they say that when there is a drop in air pressure, the air mass will drop down. Help yourself before trying to help others. So anywhere, it makes sense that you do it before you go to help others, because unless you yourself have done it, otherwise you will be misguiding others. And that's why Swami says here also, even in the mansion of self-realization, the self is the foundation or base. Otherwise, if you try to help without the self, then you don't have a foundation, you don't have a base. Instead of you transforming or helping the other person realize the truth, you might yourself get blinded in that. You know, Swami would give the other example of how the sapling of faith has to be fenced with discipline and protected from the animals and goats that come to feed on it. That is why Swami would say, keep good company. Don't keep the company of cows and goats that will chew you. Don't think that, you know, I am a devotee of Swami and let me take on the non-devotees, let me take on the critics. No, let me keep satsang. Let me be in the company of the people who love God only. Why should I try to, you know, go on the internet and read stuff which is which people have criticized Swami and think that I can measure up to them and answer them? You know, on those few occasions when I have tried to do this prem, I have ended up actually being a little shaken, you know, being a little shaken, and that is when I shut everything, go back to my own experience and close my eyes, recollect those things, meditate on it, and, you know, come back stronger. But otherwise, it really shakes you. That is why in the beginning, you have to make yourself solid, unshakable. And it should be like how, you know, Professor H.J. Bhagya in the university would tell us, if Swami comes and tells me that, Bhagya, I took you for a ride, I am not God, I will tell, I don't believe you. Means that is how our faith should be solid, that even if Swami comes and tells that, you know, I am not divine, we should be able to say, no, I have experience, how can the experience be wrong? So, until and unless we are affirmed that way, so too in this building the mansion of self-realization, unless that self-confidence is so pakka, is so thorough, unless our concept of self is thorough, let us not try to help. Because as we shall see, now we don't have the time for it, we shall see during the next fortnight of our conversation, this is where the conversation heads towards. Because somebody is saying that, I get pained when I see others in trouble, so do you mean I should not help them? So we can see already, because Bhagwan is omnipresent, omnipotent and omniscient, he's already preempting some of those questions and building up the case so beautifully. But here Swami says very clearly that self is the base, the foundation, help is the wall, God is the roof or top of the building.
And, you know, even when you talk of this help, I think the confusion here is There's a difference between helping someone monetarily and physically and with the ideas that you have got. I think it's a totally different concept altogether, and that's where I think a little bit of confusion is there. If I learn something, if I learn that this is the philosophy of life that works, I think that's a standard tendency nowadays. The first thing we want to do is we want to share it with others, or we want to impose it on others. Even before we have tried it out with ourselves, even before we have aligned ourselves to that idea or to that philosophy. And that is the nature which Swami is saying, that don't do that first. You know, you apply it to yourself, you figure it out whether it works, and then you share it. Helping somebody in need is a completely different thing. I think there, when you're looking at, you know, suppose someone is starving in front of you, definitely in that sense you are having more than that person, correct, and you can actually reach out to that person. Ideas and philosophies are a different thing. You know, you might find a poor man who might have a better idea of life than you. And, you know, there, you being a richer man does not mean that you can philosophize and give him your ideas. That's why even though there are, you know, fakirs and sadhus who are probably less richer than you and have lesser attainment than you, they can still give you more, because that prosperity is different from monetary prosperity. And I think that sharing is different from this sharing that Swami is talking. And that's one difference we have to keep in mind. It's not that Swami is saying just take care of yourself, don't think about others.
Absolutely. It is depending on the different aspects and facets, as you said. But all of that discussion, dear listeners, will have to wait for the next fortnight, because the time in our studios tell us that it is time for the afternoon satsang to conclude and the next segment by Brother Chandu, Love to begin. So that is what we will be doing right now. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for all your mails. Thank you for your feedback. Offering this at the lotus feet of our beloved Swami with gratitude and love in our heart, we'll conclude with this song, and on the other side, you will be greeted with the segment, Love to Love.
Pune mana.